Saleh, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. And before we get started, I want to mention that our call-in line, if you have questions or comments, is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history, August 24th. In AD 79, Mount Vesuvius in southern Italy erupts, burying the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum under a huge blanket of volcanic ash and debris. Many of the residents were caught in their houses and, in effect, cemented in place by the pyroclastic flow, which was excavated centuries later, exposing the horrific events of that day. In 1875, Captain Matthew Webb of England becomes the first man to swim the English Channel without assistance. He covered himself with oil to help warm his body against the chilly ocean waters, getting stung by a jellyfish shortly after he entered the channel. The remarkable feat made Webb an instant celebrity, and he later had other athletic accomplishments in the years that followed. And in 1942, after U.S. Marines had landed in the region on Guadalcanal a few weeks earlier, American troops continued to deliver heavy punishment to entrenched Japanese forces during World War II. The Battle of the East Solomon Islands was aided by Coast Watchers, men who scanned the territory for enemy troop movements. Their actions resulted in a victory for the Allies, destroying the Japanese aircraft Ryoho, along with one of their light carriers, a destroyer, and a submarine. As for the Coast Watchers, Vice Admiral William F. Halsey said, "The Coast Watchers saved Guadalcanal, and Guadalcanal saved the Pacific." It's not often that you get a chance to sit down with a professional historian and ask questions about our heritage. Most people who are interested in history read books, view movies, or search the internet for information on their favorite subjects. Our history is so rich, a tapestry of people, places, and events over more than three centuries, which have made our story unique in the annals of mankind, from the early pilgrims who escaped persecutions in Europe to later waves of immigrants from all over the world who wanted to share in this idea we call America. Professional historians make it their duty to examine this heritage, analyzing documents, letters, manuscripts, and speeches, reading the words spoken by statesmen and military officers, deciphering the actions of participants on all sides of every issue, from independence to slavery and war. Dr. Ann Venson is professor of history at American Public University, where she has taught for the past 20 years. She teaches a course on the history of World War II, which, for full disclosure, I am now completing in my master's degree program at the university, which offers an outstanding program of Dr. Venson's and numerous other graduate-level courses in history. Dr. Venson earned her bachelor's degree at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, and her Ph.D. at Princeton, conducting work on the papers of President Woodrow Wilson. Her research on World War II has brought forth a fascinating view of this global conflict, the largest in human history, to her students and those who read her works. She's with us today to discuss the many areas of her research, including the U.S. Marines. Dr. Venson, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Gene. And for full disclosure, you are doing very well in your class.
Well, thanks so much. I'm really enjoying it. And by the way, I've always been a fan of World War II, but I never learned anywhere near as much about it as I have in your class. So you are doing a tremendous job.
And we're only touching the iceberg. So.
Oh, yes. Tell us a little bit about your background. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? What were your life experiences that prompted you to become a professional historian?
Well, I grew up in Millburn, New Jersey. A family of fantastic storytellers. So listening to grandparents talk about crossing, they were immigrants, and crossing the Atlantic, one of the ships actually breaking down in the middle of the North Atlantic in the winter, things like that were very dramatic and really grabbed the attention of a little one. And of course, hearing some of the stories of my father and some of his peers during World War II, I think that really cemented it, because names like Kwajalein and Annie Wheatock were a whole lot more interesting than Little Red Riding Hood.
Mm-hmm. Now, your father did fight in World War II. What was his area of operations?
My father was actually a graduate of the Naval Academy, but cross-commissioned into the Marine Corps, and he served in the invasions of Guam and Iwo Jima.
Mm. Famous, very famous battles.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you learned kind of growing up in New Jersey and kind of the East Coast area that kind of prompted you specifically to pursue history as a career rather than just an interest?
Well, I think it really was family influences. Growing up in Millburn, we were surrounded by Revolutionary War history.
Mm-hmm.
Every fifth grader in my elementary school would walk down the hill and around the corner to visit Hessian House, which was a house that was present during the Battle of Springfield, and still had bullet holes in some of the walls.
Oh, interesting.
And there's a local cemetery from the Revolutionary War, and the Battle of Springfield was fought in front of the Springfield Presbyterian Church. So we were pretty much, as you are in your area, surrounded by the Revolutionary, and that was the fun part of school.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I currently live in Kennett Square, PA, just kind of west, southwest of Philadelphia, but we're just down the road from Brandywine Battlefield, so that's a fairly famous place. Now, you've been teaching for 20 years at APU. Just tell us a little bit, aside from World War II, what are other subjects of your interest and teaching there?
Well, I start out with I teach the two introductory undergraduate courses, the United States from 1492 to 1877, and then from 1877 to present day. But I also teach the American Revolution in context, World War One in context, courses on U.S. diplomatic and military history, great power interventions, of course, the master's capstone.
Mm-hmm.
We may see you again when you're writing your thesis.
That's right. Well, I'm actually going to be starting it next month, but I'm done all my courses for the program up right up through now, and I'll actually be writing my master's thesis on Alexander Hamilton starting next month. But you're just curious, at Lafayette, did you take any history courses?
One or two.
Mm-hmm. And now, was that your major?
Yes, I was a history major. In fact, I had I ended up with a double major in history and government.
Oh, excellent.
But we had some wonderful history professors there. Richard Welch, who unfortunately is no longer with us, who was so generous with his time, and even after I was long graduated with a doctorate, I could still call him up and, Professor Welch, I'm stuck. And he was, well, you know, Ms. Venzin, you know, and point me in the right direction. It was great.
Right, so they had a very solid history department there.
Very much so, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Princeton, of course, very well known, well, probably one of the best known professors, I think, at Princeton in recent years is James McPherson.
Absolutely.
The Civil War author has written numerous books on the topic. Have you ever met McPherson?
Yes, but I'm so old, he was an assistant professor when I was there.
Oh, is that right? Well, he's, I think, in his 80s.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as I said, I'm old. Just ask my 9-year-old granddaughter.
Well, that is an outstanding institution. I understand you did your PhD dissertation on a famous Marine, Smedley Darlington Butler, who grew up in Westchester.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about Butler and his life in the military, his accomplishments.
Oh, goodness. Butler's father was a congressman, and Butler was not fascinated by school. He was a good student, but he was not gripped by school. And when the Spanish-American War broke out, he wheedled, cajoled, and threatened until his parents finally agreed to allow him to leave school and join the Marine Corps. So he started as a pea-green second lieutenant. This is, at this point, a 17-year-old kid who knew nothing and arrives in Cuba He learned fast and became an outstanding leader. Served in the Boxer Rebellion, in the Philippines, in the Banana Wars in Central America. At the beginning of World War I, he was, in his terms, stuck in Haiti during the American occupation there. Participated in the landing in Veracruz, headed the embarkation camp at Pontonnaison in France, went back to China. Smedley was everywhere, and never happier than when he was trudging along with his men.
Now, did he ever interact with Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders?
No, no. He, Butler was at Guantanamo Bay, and the Rough Riders were at closer to San Diego.
I see.
So they did not ever meet. He thought very highly of Teddy, but to my knowledge, there was no meeting there.
Roughly, the reason why I ask is they're roughly contemporaneous,
yes.
Somewhat contemporaneous. We've got just under a minute before we take a break. You know, you have a lot of interest in a famous Marine who, I guess, Butler was one of the most decorated Marines of his era. Have you done any follow-up work on other Marines in the last year or two, last few years?
Well, I wrote another book, biography of Holland M. Smith, who was a Marine who was very instrumental in developing amphibious landing craft and then saw them in operation in the Pacific. That was a fascinating piece of research.
So that's been recent. That's fairly recent for you.
Well, it's about 6 years ago now.
Okay, not too long ago. Well, very good. Well, you know, the Marines, of course, involved in a lot of actions all around the world. Big actions during World War II, especially in the Pacific. And I have personally been learning a lot about those. But we will follow up right after this commercial break. Stay with us. We have Dr. Ann Venson, and we are doing Living History.
Do you have a wedding, graduation, baptism, confirmation, milestone, or birthday to plan? You need John Surratt Catering, one of the most highly rated and preferred caterers throughout the Philadelphia area. They will be there to create and cater your event while assisting as much or as little as you desire. Planning a decadent, over-the-top company gala? Need help transforming your backyard into the party of the year? Want to wow your clients with a delicious luncheon? Then you need John Surratt Catering. All you have to do is call and they'll handle the rest. Located at 835 Lincoln Avenue in Westchester, visit them at SurrockCatering.com or call 610-640-2836. That's 610-640-2836.
If you had to choose a roofer, would you choose one with limited experience and knowledge, or would you choose a roofer certified as a master elite contractor by the largest manufacturer in the nation, GAF, a distinction shared by only 3% of the nation's roofers? I'm talking about GP Martini Roofing, who also does siding, windows, doors, and offers an ironclad guarantee that he'll repair or replace any roof for defects within its normal life. GP Martini Services, Chester, Delaware, Bucks, and Montgomery counties, with free estimates and consultation, and does both commercial and residential. Go to their website at martiniroofing.com for special savings, or call 610-873-1696. And also, financing is available with no payments for a full year. Now, what roofer would you call? GP Martini is the answer, 610-873-1696.
From Westchester to Coatesville, from Kennett to Chester Springs, from Parksburg to Paoli, this is your home for all things Chester County. WCHE 1520 AM, the talk of Chester County.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we're speaking with Dr. Ann Venson, Professor of History at American Public University. Dr. Venson, you teach a course on World War II, which I'm taking and I feel is excellent. What fascinates you most about this conflict? Obviously the largest in human history. What really just kind of grabs your attention about World War II?
Well, you hit on part of it. It's the absolute magnitude of the conflict. I think about the only place where it wasn't fought was Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it a world war. Also, the people involved. I'm particularly interested in how they got to the tipping point where Hitler invaded Poland.
Mm-hmm.
What got them there? The World War One was supposed to be the war that ended all wars.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that interwar period and how we get to Britain's finest hour, the Battle of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
That I find intriguing, and it's like Quicksilver. Every time you think you've got a hold of it, there's something new.
There's something more to explore, yeah.
Always.
I had a professor, believe it or not, a professor of art history at Bucknell University as an undergrad, who was a veteran of World War II, and he said, talking about the wartime one day, he said, well, there was the Great War, but we fought in the Big War. And
mm-hmm.
I guess a lot of the veterans call it the Big War because it was, by definition, the largest and
yes.
just so extensive. Have you done much research or any exploration of the relationship between Monty and Patton? Apparently that relationship was very, very feisty, and they I don't know that they really liked each other very much at all. Have you done much on that?
I haven't really focused on that, but just over the years and the research that I've gotten, I think it's safe to say that Patton's relationship with anyone could be prickly, and Monty's relationship with anyone could be prickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very good thing that Dwight Eisenhower was the Supreme Allied Commander, because he was one of the few people that could handle the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, both very headstrong, I guess, personalities, you could say. Am I correct in assuming that, at least from my readings, that Patton could be considered the more successful general, or am I wrong?
I think in many ways he would. That's a correct assessment. He achieved his objectives more often than Monty did. Monty was more scrupulous with his men. He didn't want to move until he had everything in place. Much more a creature of the devastation of World War One
mm-hmm.
than Patton was. Now, Patton had served in World War One, but the Americans came to the game in 1917.
Yeah, a bit late in the game.
Montgomery had seen so much more, and not that either one of them was flippant with the lives of their men, but Montgomery had a different mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've sensed that. And by the way, the movie Patton, which I believe won 8 Academy Awards, highlights mm-hmm. their kind of personal battles quite well. When the book The Greatest Generation came out several years back, did you see some increased interest in your course?
We did some. But interests kind of ebb and flow. That was a big deal. So was the Band of Brothers.
Yes.
That I've had many students say, I had to take this course after I've seen Band of Brothers. It's my favorite. And of course, that perpetuates it. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say that the Band of Brothers is, let's say, more accurate than your typical TV documentary? Or there's still a lot of things that are kind of romanticized in that, too?
I don't think I would say that there is much in there that's actually romanticized. It, mm-hmm. it comes, from my understanding, not having been there myself, it comes very close to reality, as close as we can come.
Mm-hmm.
I've had folks, veterans, say, yeah, that's about as good as we're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't smell it, you can't mm-hmm. see it, you can't feel it,
mm-hmm.
but that's pretty close. I've had veterans say the same thing about the opening of Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Some of whom were so traumatized by the reality of it, they actually walked out of the theater. I can't mm-hmm. stay and see this.
Mm-hmm. So realistic. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You know, as a history student and really longtime history buff, I love visiting historic sites. Have you ever gotten a chance to visit any World War II sites? Like more Normandy or anything in any place in Europe?
No, actually, and this sounds terrible, I do have a bucket list, but I also had two young children in school and had to teach, and there wasn't much time for that.
I understand. I come from a big family myself, but go ahead.
One of the things that I would recommend to everybody is, if you have a chance, go visit the Intrepid that's in New York. It's now a museum down on the waterfront near, I think it's 42nd or 44th Street Pier. And you get a sense of the size of a World War II aircraft carrier. It looks very different in person than it does when you see a movie.
Oh, I bet. You know, I've personally been on a nuclear submarine. I worked with a gentleman who was formerly in the Navy, and I got to go on board the USS Nautilus in San Diego Harbor. This is many years ago. And that was interesting. And for our listeners who don't know this, right across the state, all you have to do is cross the bridge into New Jersey. You can see the USS Battleship New Jersey, which is a great living memorial. And, in fact, I wrote about it in one of my papers. It's just a fantastic living museum. And, by the way, I have not been there yet, so I plan to visit there. A lot of World War II memorabilia to be seen not too far away. The author Stephen Ambrose did quite a bit of work on World War II. In fact, taught at the University of New Orleans. Just curious, have you ever had any contact with him or any of the other authors on World War II?
I actually have had much more contact with authors on World War I.
Okay.
Starting with Arthur Link, who was the guru, the dean of all things Woodrow Wilson, with Kendrick Clement and John Milton Cooper, many of the folks who have written on World War One.
Now, you did a lot of work on the papers of President Woodrow Wilson. Tell us a little bit about your research there.
I started out as a graduate student working for Professor Link because I was interested in documentary editing. In fact, my dissertation was an edited edition of Smedley Butler's papers for the period when he was head of the Haitian Constabulary from 1915 to 1917. So we did a lot of the grunt work of going and finding the sources for the annotations and sometimes writing the annotations that went in the 69 volumes of the papers of Woodrow Wilson, which was a fantastic experience because I might have gone to class and learned a lot of fact and learned how to analyze and synthesize, but working on the papers of Woodrow Wilson taught me how to be an historian.
Fascinating. Now, did you get, obviously you got a first-hand look at his personal papers, I mean, things he wrote, letters to him, letters he sent. Did you get a feeling of the person rather than the president?
Yes. An extremely passionate man about anything that he was involved with. A devoted husband, a devoted father, very religious man. Not the rather cold fish that many of his portraits show us.
And there was
a volcano under there.
No, I believe it. I have not read much on Wilson, but I believe he is the only president with a PhD. Is that correct?
To my knowledge, yes.
Yeah, and he was also president of Princeton.
Yes. And governor of New Jersey.
And governor, yes. So quite a bit of experience in that region. President Woodrow Wilson has been commented on over the decades as being a bit late getting into World War One, as I guess some authors have also said that FDR was just a tad late getting into World War Two. Do you have any comment on the thoughts that some people think that America has been somewhat isolationist over the decades?
I would agree with that, and that has not always served us badly. Starting with World War II first, the fact that we did not jump in as soon as Hitler invaded Poland aggravated Winston Churchill no end because he wanted the full force of the United States behind the Allies. But it gave the United States some time to ramp up industrially, better than if we had just immediately jumped into the war. sometimes having the grace of, you know, 30 seconds to think about what you're doing mm-hmm. is a good thing.
Yes.
Going back to World War One, there was a tremendous isolationist feeling at that point, mm-hmm. and the election of 1916 was won by Wilson's slogan, "He kept us out of war."
Exactly, yeah.
Of course, a few months later, he's starting the preparedness movement, and Teddy Roosevelt's still use of the bully pulpit is not looking quite as wrong. But it mm-hmm. wasn't until the Germans came back with unrestricted submarine warfare mm-hmm. In January of 1917 that it was, we can't do this anymore.
Right.
We have got to join in.
Got to get in there, yeah. You mentioned you've written a book on a famous Marine. Tell us a bit about the books you've written.
Well, the first one was my dissertation, which we turned into a book that was a selected edition of Smedley Butler's letters from 1898 until he retired in 1931.
Mm, okay.
I also wrote the book on Holland Smith, also known as Howland Mad Smith,
mm-hmm.
And that's very, very different. That's a standard biography.
Mm-hmm.
I've also edited an encyclopedia on the United States in the First World War.
Mm.
That was a great deal of fun.
Fascinating.
It was, and met some wonderful authors, and we really explored it from every angle. I've also done some bibliographic work on the Spanish-American War.
Excellent.
And most recently wrote a book called Leaders of Men, and it's about 10 lesser-known Marines who really had an impact on carrying on the tradition of leadership in the Marine Corps from the post-Civil War era to the interwar period that we were just talking about.
Excellent. That's quite a wide swath of history there. Are any of your books available for our readers on or listeners on Amazon?
They better all be.
That's great. So if you're listening in, you can put in Dr. Ann Venson on Amazon and find some of her books on history. We've got less than a minute left. One thing I was just going to ask you as a final question is, you know, a lot of Americans really are, so to speak, history deficient.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't know very much about our own heritage. What comments do you have for people, students, teachers, readers, just people in general, about the importance of history and understanding it?
Well, first of all, history does not have to be boring because there is something in history for everybody. Even if you're a sports fan, there's the history of sports,
mm-hmm.
History of medicine, history of science. You name it, there is something for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, particularly in an election year, say, take a deep breath, investigate a little bit, because you're going to make a wiser decision. You're going to be a better citizen by knowing where we've come from and what's at stake than if you blithely just listen to sound bites and listen to the commentators. If nothing else, turn off the commentators and read the speeches. Read a little bit of history yourself. You really can think. You don't need someone telling you what to think.
Excellent. I agree completely. Very well said. Dr. Venson, thank you so much for joining with us today on my show, Living History. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday, August 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern, when we'll be speaking with Brad and Leela Gaylor of the Gaylor Estate Winery here in South Chester County. Thank you all very much for joining us today for Living History.